Hello, everyone. Welcome.
Hey, James.
Started like that every time.
You know, we need to start off on an exciting tone.
And like a carnival barker. Like.
Yes. Oh, hey, kids. Welcome all down to the We Rebel tent. I do want to start off.
The bearded lady and xenophobia. And
oh, God. I do want to start off with the most important issue this week. In case you haven't heard, today is Monday, August 7th, which means it's my birthday.
Yay. Happy birthday, Dave.
Happy birthday. I thought you were going to say happy birthday, Dave. I was like, his name is James.
Why did you think I was going to say Dave?
I heard it as Dave. Also, you get so mad at me when I play my trumpets. And then we have
because
this.
Nick, this is the one time I've been selfish.
He gets a day, Nick.
In 11
he gets one
episodes.
Day.
I feel very attacked.
You get all the other days.
Happy birthday.
As a straight white male here in Trump's America.
Oh my God.
Just saying.
All right. So Nick, what did you want to start with?
I wanted to say happy birthday to President Obama, a personal hero of mine.
But his birthday isn't today.
Yes, but it was August 4th. We celebrated a great Obama day. Happy birthday.
I hope everyone had a great Obama
Mr.
Day.
Mr. President, his 56th. Hope he's doing well. But because of his birthday, I just wanted to bring up an article from May that Business Insider wrote about because Trump was celebrating his job numbers, and yet he's introduced no piece of legislation that has any effect on the economy, and the fact that he has any good economic news whatsoever is because of Barack Obama's contributions. So if you're excited about the 22,000 point index on the Dow, that's because of Barack Obama. If you're excited about continuous job growth, that's because of Barack Obama. And if you're excited about the lessening, the gradual decline of the unemployment rate, that is because of President Barack Obama. So happy birthday, Mr. President. Mm-hmm. Woo! All right, let's move on. Guys, the mooch is gone.
10 days.
It was a week! Yeah. I know that this is already old news, which is insane. But Scaramucci's gone.
We talked about it last week, didn't we?
No, we talked about the fact that Scaramucci was in, and now we're talking
about
that
how he's out.
He got fired the day after the episode.
I did. I mean, there are so many funny memes in the world, but I saw a particularly funny one for this that was like, raise your hand if you've ever had a period longer than Scaramucci was in office. Geez. And it was like, yeah.
I have.
Every female in the world has.
Somebody
I thought it was very funny.
Somebody tweeted that the series of concerts that Fish just did at Madison Square Garden lasted longer than Scaramucci's tenure. Mm-hmm.
There's so many things that last longer than 10 days.
Everyone's saying like, oh, the poor, or not everyone, but some people were like, this guy gave up his business. He is getting divorced from his wife. This
happened in the middle of the week.
This it's a sad story. No. You know what's sad? It's his wife that had to deliver a baby alone and then got a text message that said, I'm praying for our son. Fuck Anthony Scaramucci. Mm-hmm. It's not a sad story for him.
Also, I think, if I remember correctly, his job wasn't supposed to start until August 15th.
Yeah, he has a negative, which, by the way, is my birthday.
Look at that. See?
Also, James and I are having a joint birthday party, so if you guys want to come out, if you're in Los Angeles,
come see it.
I'm not going to tell you where, but it's going to be sweet. Very hype.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Ooh.
I apologize. I apologize profusely.
All right. Now that we lost 10,000 viewers.
Anyways, wow. If we had 10,000 at the beginning, that'd be very cool. So Scaramucci's gone. John Kelly is the new chief of staff. And there was a New York Times article written by Michael Shear, Glenn Thrush, and Maggie Haberman, the usual suspects. And John F. Kelly, President Trump's new chief of staff, firmly asserted his authority on his first day in the White House on Monday, telling aides he will impose military discipline on a free-for-all West Wing, and underscored his intent by firing Anthony Scaramucci, the bombastic communications director, 10 days after he was hired. That's so funny. Scaramucci didn't know. And then John Kelly got sworn in, walked into his office, and was like, you're fired. Truly incredible. I don't like John Kelly because I think he has a lot of, you know.
And I believe he was escorted off the White House.
He was
premises.
Escorted off the. There was the New York Post had a Trump Survivor cover. And it was like the show Survivor, but with Trump and his staff.
Sure.
And within 2 days of that being posted or that going out on the front page of the New York Post, two members that were on the cover had been fired.
Yeah, I mean, in the same article, it says, for the time being, the White House may leave the communication director position open and a person close to internal discussions on the job. And then also, it looks like they also haven't filled the post with someone from Homeland Security.
Oh, well, John Kelly was the head of the Department of Homeland Security.
Got it.
And so, yeah, now they don't know who they're going to put in charge of that. And there's rumors that Stephen Miller, everyone's favorite cue ball Nazi.
Oh, my gosh, he scares me.
Who also had, honestly, the craziest press conference with Jim Acosta.
He looks like an angry Q-tip.
Yeah, well, he also like said a lot of like crazy white nationalist undertones. Mm-hmm. He called, this is one of my favorite tweets of the week, Duke grad and Santa Monica native Stephen Miller called Jim Acosta, son of Cuban immigrant, a cosmopolitan elitist. I was like, are you out of your mind? You went to Duke and you're from Santa Monica? If you ever get to go to Santa Monica, it's like the capital city in the Hunger Games. Stephen Miller needs to shut his fucking mouth. Ugh. Disgusting. What a terrible human.
That was, I'm not adding any new information. His little part in the press briefing was so odd.
It was,
and the way he was speaking to Jimmy.
It's because he's just like a 30-year-old man child who has no idea how to operate within the confines of a government, let alone like a recess at a middle school playground.
Right.
Ugh. Anyways. Should we move on? I think we should move on.
We're just blazing through today. We have a really cool interview coming up.
Yeah, so we're all really excited for you to get to the interview. But these things are important.
These are important, yeah. We just want you to get to the,
But what we're going to talk about next, Washington Post released the Trump transcripts of his
full transcripts
of his calls to Mexico and Australia.
The president of President Enrique Nieto, and then the Prime Minister of Australia, Malcolm Turnbull.
Now,
I got that.
Yes,
without even looking it up.
Look at you,
it's my
gold
birthday,
star for the day. It's not your birthday yet. Give me my day. So this article by Greg Miller, Julie Witkowskia. Okay, I said all that wrong.
Julie Witkowskia.
There we go. Okay, I was sort of right. And Ruben Fischer-Bohm. So if you get a chance to look at this article on Washington Post, it reads like a play. And I kind of want to see this staged. I think it would be hysterical.
I didn't think of that.
Because
really
when you look at it, because what they'll do is they kind of break down the exact word for word what's going on, but then they'll make little annotations on the side to give you some context about what they're talking about. Very telling how Trump was handling this conversation, especially, really with both. When he called President Nieto, he called him by his first name, Enrique, 13 times in the interview.
He never once called him Mr. President.
Never once. Whereas Nieto, he called him Mr. President every single time. Mm-hmm. And that's very telling of Mr. Trump and his way of addressing those who are equal to him. But
Said he won New Hampshire because New Hampshire is a drug-infested den. He didn't win New Hampshire, and that's incredibly offensive. And then, this is a quote that he said to the president of Mexico, you have some pretty tough hombres in Mexico that you may need help with, and we're willing to help you with that big league, but they have to be knocked out, and you have not done a good job of knocking them out. Woo! I don't know. I think the question I want to ask you guys is, this is obviously very troubling that the transcripts have come out, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what he says in the transcripts, rather, is very troubling. But it is also troubling, whether we have a bad opinion of Trump or not, that the transcripts are being leaked. And I'm curious what you guys think of that. I mean, this is classified information. This is private conversation between two world leaders that is getting leaked out. And yes, it's interesting to see. And yes, we want to know what he's saying and if he's telling the truth, and he is once again lying because he said his conversation with Prime Minister Turnbull went well. But what do you guys think about this? This is dangerous.
Well, we had a discussion like this a couple weeks ago, I think. And I think it's in the same way of where Edward Snowden during Obama's term, you know, he came out, he brought out information that needed, essentially we should know. We should know these things are happening. And I think there are people that will blindly defend Trump every step of the way. You know, he can make a lot of false claims, make a lot of claims without any facts, any evidence whatsoever, and yet no one will question him. So when you see things like this, when you see that he's talking to world leaders like this, and giving such misguided and misinformed information out. You know, I think you need to, it's you need to see it for what it is and say like, okay, your president is lying. Mm-hmm. And you need to be educate yourself so you know what's going on in your own country, because he clearly doesn't. Or if he does, he's being ignorant to it.
Yeah. And I think it's also another example of his campaign rhetoric and what he says in the rallies being the exact same rhetoric that he uses in negotiations. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, there's another quote where he's like, we cannot say that anymore, because if you're going to say that Mexico is not going to pay for all, then I don't want them to meet with you guys anymore, because I cannot live with that. And it's like, you can't live with it. Like none of his language is productive, and almost reading the transcript was kind of like, but what are you actually talking about? What is actually going on? And what is the option you're proposing? There was no initiative on his side to say, okay, you won't pay for the wall, I'm not paying for the wall, but like here's XYZ options, even if I personally, as Emily, don't agree with any of those options and don't think we need a wall, et cetera. You know, he presents any sort of version of a solution. None of it happens.
Yeah.
But to answer your original question of, you know, what about these being leaked? You know, half my brain is like, this is really interesting and we're learning more or being reaffirmed in our opinion of Trump, you know, of how he interacts with world leaders. And that's good for people to know how he's actually doing his job with like primary information, not some quote unquote source from the White House. But on the flip side, yeah, it's incredibly dangerous.
Yeah.
And like, where's the line? I don't know where the line is, but where's the line on what does and doesn't come out of the White House in terms of primary information? Because I do wish we got more of this, of just data, so we can all, you know, think through it and understand what's actually happening. Mm-hmm. So that part of me is like, yay, because it's just raw information.
Right.
But on the other side, it's like, what if it was raw information about something
like no one's lives are on the line, you know, from this conversation?
From this conversation, but the ones that where people's lives are on the line.
Well, I mean,
and in some ways, lives are on the line.
I was going to say,
because we're
talking about the 1,200.
We're talking about quote unquote knocking out the drug lords,
right? But also,
like,
I mean,
those are people too.
The 1,200 immigrants in Australia that was agreed upon in the Obama administration, and what Prime Minister Turnbull tried to explain was that you don't even need to, he was like, you don't even need to take these people. You just need to vet them.
Yep.
And in the conversation, he's like, we've been watching them for 3 years. They're all, they're economically forced out of their country. And Trump doesn't understand that. All he hears are immigrants coming from Pakistan or Iraq or any of these Middle Eastern countries. And he assumes, he says, I mean, in he's quoted as saying, I think they're all bad people. I think they're all bad people. This is a bad deal. I can't take them. And he's like, you don't even have to take them. We've vetted them for 3 years. They're safe. You can vet them too. That's all it's agreed to. I don't know. I just...
And also there was a lot of the transcripts that was him circling back to himself. Like, it makes me look bad. Like, this is going to kill me. Me. Mm-hmm. And there is a dynamic that happens when someone gets in office where they do have... They're supposed to deliver on their promises.
Yeah.
You know, and so he's in a way trying to do that here. But also, you know, at some point it stops becoming about your campaign promises and it becomes about what's best for the country.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I don't foresee him ever getting to that tipping point this isn't no longer about the fact that I'm president and this is now about the United States of America.
Yeah.
And he's never once thought from that perspective.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's, to talk about this, now the DOJ, the Department of Justice, is starting to, they're putting a bigger increase on crackdowns of leakers, and one of their targets is the media, of getting sources. So that's a fascist tactic.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to be aware of that, and cognizant of that. They're trying to get sources from the media, which is, like the leak or not, if it's leaked,
it's out there.
It's out there. And like, you know, leakers are what took down the Nixon administration.
Yep.
So, you know, the fact that they're doing this and ramping that up is very problematic.
Yeah.
Should we move on to
Emily's favorite topic?
Ugh.
Russia.
Da, 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 da,
all right. So from our good friends at WAPO, Trump dictated his son's misleading statement on meeting with the Russian lawyer.
Yeah, actually, before we go into this, can you imagine how relieved Emily is going to be when this is all done? Because it means
going to be so happy.
Well, it means maybe no more talking about Russia. It also means probably no more president.
So that's a win-win.
The last president of the United States?
That's well, no, no, I mean, I was going to say, I didn't want to say his full name. No more 45.
No more 45. Do you think they'll just like skip 45 in the history books and go 44, 46?
No, you know, and I think this is important, and I'm not, I know I'm talking about the competition here, but I did go see a certain podcast called Moms Made of America, and somebody brought this up, and John Lovett said, no, keep it in the books. You have to keep it in the books
as
a reminder.
You have to keep it in the books. Yeah. And also, there are some tactics, you know, that he used that if it was a different person would be great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's you know? The 45th president of the United States. It's hard for anybody. It's yeah. hard for me to say. It's hard for me to realize and talk mm-hmm. about he is. And we need to remember that because, you know.
He's going to be on an AP U.S. history test. That's what.
He's gonna
absolutely.
Be, he's going to be an me. AP U.S. history class.
No.
Yeah.
All right. Anyway, so
back to this.
Yes. This
article. I will be relieved. By but Ashley back to the article.
This article by Ashley Parker, Carol D. Lenning, Phil Rucker, and Tom Hamburger.
Tommy Hams.
All right. So essentially, we find out on the sidelines of the Group of 20 summit in Germany last month, President Trump's advisors discussed how to respond to the new revelation that Trump's oldest son had met with a Russian lawyer during the 2016 campaign. Disclosure that advisors knew carried political and potentially legal peril. Essentially, what they figured out was that they had made up this plan where this is what we're going to say. We're going to put this out there. Everything's fine. Within hours, at the president's direction, that plan changed. So when they were flying home in Germany from Germany on July 8th, Trump personally dictated a statement in which Trump Jr. said that he and the Russian lawyer had discussed the program about adoption of Russian children when they met in June 2016, according to multiple people with knowledge of those deliberations. That statement issued to the New York Times as it prepared an article emphasized that the subject of the meeting was not a campaign issue at the time. So that was a big old lie. They fabricated this whole facade for this. They were not talking about Russian adoption. And here we are once again swimming in some treason stew.
Yeah.
It's still cooking.
Still mm-hmm. cooking. Emily, thoughts?
No. No thoughts.
Anything to talk about?
No.
Huh. Nothing?
Stew, stew, stew. It's another ingredient. Another example of a lie.
Well, then, so
and add it to the list.
If we're moving on. There was a Newsweek article that came out that said Rex Tillerson rejected $80 million from Congress to fight Russian propaganda because it would anger Moscow. Now, Rex Tillerson, you might remember him as the Secretary of State to the United States who received a friendship order of friendship award from Putin. From Putin. In like 2016, not 10 years ago.
I love the term order of friendship. I think we should bring that back.
What did he get? I'm going to look it exactly up.
I love that. I'm going to start giving some of those out.
I'd rather join the Order of the Phoenix.
There's one person.
Oh, no, it is. It's the Russian Order of Friendship.
Oh, I'm going to start. We're going to send out We Rebel Orders of Friendship. to friends of the pod.
If you subscribe.
But there's one person you don't want it from, and that is Putin.
Well, okay, so if for an administration that constantly denies Russian news and says that it's a witch hunt and all this stuff, if you're given $80 million from the State Department to fight Russian propaganda and misinformation, say yes. Take the money. Use it. Use it to squash all these things. But no, he's saying we're going to anger Moscow if I take this money. So no, we're not going to do it. You look guilty as hell now.
He also said in a briefing to reporters at the State Department Tuesday, this is a quote from the article, Tillerson said that neither the president nor I were very happy about Congress's recent decision to pass a bill to block the president from lifting those and other U.S. sanctions against Russia without congressional approval. So let's go back here. Rex Tillerson, you may know him as the Secretary of State of the United States, was the former CEO of ExxonMobil that had a drilling project in Russia that was not able to go through because of the sanctions. He also had the Order of Friendship from Putin. He is the Secretary of State. I don't know how to make it more clear that they're like knee deep in this. It's not like a, you know, you don't have to like, you know, yarn ball this on a wall with pictures connecting Tillerson.
There is no war room trying to figure this out.
There is no war room. It is just out there.
A very clear image.
They're holding hands in the lockers right near the gym, and everybody can see it. And it's like, yo, are Rex and Putin dating? I think so. I think so. I've been watching too much Riverdale.
So now I'm thinking the order of friendship is like one of those notes you pass. Like, do you like me? Check yes or no.
No, Rex Maybe. Tillerson definitely likes Putin. No like here. We're in double like territory. So Bob Mueller, future American icon and face of the $50 bill, Bob Mueller, his job, the Senate, the Congress right now is working to protect Bob Mueller's job. And there's a Senate bipartisan bill, and it is being sponsored by Republican Senator Tom Tillis. He spells Tom, T-H-O-M, which is very weird. And Democratic Senator Chris Coons of Delaware. This is from a CBS News article, and I don't know who the writers are. It's very frustrating. CBS doesn't list the writers, so I'm sorry I can't credit them. They plan to introduce legislation, or I think they already have, and the bill allows the counsel for the Department of Justice to challenge his or her removal in court with a review by a 3-judge panel within 14 days of the challenge. So there is bipartisan support right now, a bipartisan passing of a bill that was veto-proof that makes it impossible for Trump to roll back sanctions. Now we have a bill that has bipartisan support making it impossible to fire Bob Mueller, who is investigating him for collusion with Russia. So if you're like a Trump fan, not even your representative really trusts him anymore. Your representative who's met him and works with him doesn't trust him anymore.
But I'm glad Republicans are finally stepping up and saying like, okay, clearly shit's going down. And rather than, you know, playing party over country, they're saying, okay, well then let's get to the bottom of this, figure it out.
Yeah, let's finish this. Yeah. Let's make it so he can't get fired so we can finish this investigation.
And then right as that bill happens, Bob Mueller impanels a Washington grand jury. Isn't that interesting?
Yep.
Right as it happens?
Serendipity.
My tinfoil hat is a tinfoil mask right now. I have a tinfoil body.
He's the tin
suit.
Man. You just can't see it. There's a lot of clanking going
Cuckoo,
on.
Cuckoo, ka-choo.
What?
Like I am the Eggman?
Yeah.
But you could have, you didn't go for a Wizard of Oz reference? I said Tin Man?
I like the Beatles more than I like the works of.
I can't stand you.
Guys, they actually love each other. It's okay.
Okay. So, he's got a special counsel that he's impaneled. Because there already was one in Virginia, Alexandria, to assist in the criminal investigation of Michael Flynn, former national security advisor. That probe, which has been taken over by Mr. Mueller's team, focused on Flynn's work in the private sector on behalf of foreign interests. So we've got that. We've got the Washington grand jury. You know, like, here's the thing. For those who don't know, grand juries are powerful investigative tools that allow prosecutors to subpoena documents, put witnesses under oath, and seek indictments if there is evidence of a crime. So legal experts are saying that the decision by Mr. Mueller to impanel a grand jury suggests he believes he will need to subpoena records and take testimony from witnesses. So he's at a point now in his investigation where he can ask the questions he needs to ask. And he can ask them from the people he needs to see.
But I think it's also important to note, and this is a 2014 article, so this was not written any time in this futuristic nightmare world that we all live. Zachary Goldfarb of the Washington Post created a chart, and it shows that federal grand juries indict 99.99% of the time. So from October 2009 to September 2010, U.S. prosecutors pursued 193,000 cases and prosecuted 162,350. Of the more than 30,000 they didn't prosecute, 11 cases were because a grand jury did not return an indictment. 11. So 99.99% of the time there's an indictment. So, and I know there's people on the news that are saying, there was one, you know, somebody in the news was saying, you know, this is to be expected. Don't get too excited. And sure, absolutely. Temper your expectations here because anything is possible in this reality that we live in. That being said, this is a clear sign of something's happening. Bob Mueller wouldn't do this unless something was happening. The lawyers that he's brought in, these are the best lawyers in the world. Do you know how much money they make? They have all either left their practices or suspended to get in on this. I mean, it's not going to happen. I mean, they just brought in a couple new guys that like left their very, very cushy jobs.
We'll refer to a little quote here from this article. How important is it that Mueller has formed a grand jury? I asked 20 legal experts by Sean Illing. This is a Vox.com article. And we're going to reference a law professor from the established University of Michigan.
Go Blue.
Samuel Gross. He says federal grand juries do two things. They indict people or occasionally decline to indict them and help prosecutors conduct investigations. In the run-of-the-mill cases, their main role is to issue indictments based on investigations that have already been conducted. But in some big cases, they are critical to the investigations themselves because grand juries, unlike prosecutors and law enforcement agents, can issue both subpoenas and compel witnesses to answer questions under oath.
Yeah.
Like, this is great.
Well, also, and then after that, Reuters broke that the grand jury subpoenas issued in relation to Trump Jr. They issued a grand jury subpoena in relation to Trump Jr. Russian lawyer meeting. So that's already happened. So the grand jury was formed. We were all figuring out what they do. And it was like saying, oh, you could issue subpoenas. You can bring people. They have to testify under oath. And then Trump Jr. gets issued a subpoena. So if you need evidence that it's ramping up, his son for that meeting, which he is potentially in legal jeopardy of, has already been subpoenaed. So
now these aren't televised. They do not broadcast these. I don't believe.
Yeah. No, no,
you won't be able to. You won't be able to see
It'll
them.
It'll probably get leaked, but
exactly. Well, yeah,
which is honestly like a federal crime.
Currently going. We'll probably see it anyways.
Emily, do you want to do the last one?
Oh sure. It's very sad.
It is very sad.
Ugh. All right. So. Other Troubles Around the Nation is the title. There was an article that came out in Kansas City about how the NAACP issues its first ever travel advisory for a state, and it's the state of Missouri, one where I have 36 cousins living in.
What? First cousins? First cousins?
Wow.
Yep.
You have 36 first cousins?
Yeah, you want some? They're all in Missouri.
I'm good, but
yeah, I got plenty.
Mm-hmm.
But geez.
How many brothers and sisters do your parents have?
Both parents had 7 siblings, but both of them lost a sibling before like child rearing ages. So 12 sets of aunts.
So 12, 36, 3 kids each. Okay, that's reasonable.
My goodness.
Actually, no, it's on one
Quick
side.
Math.
Thank you.
Anyways, so this very depressing article was talking about how NAACP officials say that their recent travel advisory for Missouri is the first that the civil rights has issued for any state. It's because of recent legislation making discrimination lawsuits harder to win in response to the longtime racial disparities and traffic enforcements and incidents, examples that have caused harm to minority residents and visitors. They include racial slurs against the black students at the University of Missouri, the death earlier this year of 28 Tory Sanders,
20-year-old.
And many other things. 28 years old.
Mm-hmm. And if you get a chance, you should read this article because the Tory Sanders story is incredibly, it's very sad.
It is very sad. And it's just, it's kind of a bizarre concept that it's even necessary. When I was reading, I was like, what? Because, you know, I feel like, especially now, we view like state lines as no big deal. You know, there's no like, there's a picture, there's like a sign on the highway that you cross over into a state and then it's just, you're in a different state.
Yeah.
But it's abundantly clear now that that there's a need for more awareness when you go into certain areas, which I know is true, but it's just, it feels very archaic.
Well, it's
almost, feels like a callback to like the Civil War where it's like, oh, you crossed the Mason-Dixon line. Mm-hmm. Like now you're in this whole different thing.
Yeah.
Well, it kind of goes back to, like, for instance, when Jeff Sessions, he was trying to get legislation passed with this war on marijuana and specifically to target those that were people of color that were in possession of marijuana, because they knew it was an easy way to get them behind bars. You know, there's so many instances of minorities, people of color, anything, you know, that they're being targeted. And now when you're seeing that there's legislation passed so that it's harder to defend yourself as a person of color, like that it's terrifying.
It's terrifying.
Well, also, I mean, there's an article that came out a little bit ago from The Root, and it said Ferguson, Missouri activists are dying and it's time to ask questions. And Edward Crawford was found shot to death. Darren Seals in 2016, DeAndre Joshua. I mean, all of these Ferguson, Missouri activists are dying and no one's talking about it. Mm-hmm. And it's It's terrible. Like the NAACP is putting out a warning, and it really should chill you to the core. And it should be national news.
It should be national news. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so. That's so true.
And I guess and that's part of why, because I was talking last week about how I despise the 24-hour news cycle in America. It's horribly wrong. But if you're going to be on for that many hours of the day, you could cover a story like this. And you could talk about it, and you could bring on the experts and the people that know what they're talking about, and we start a conversation on issues like this.
Right. Yeah, because as much as we want to think this is the only state where it's happening, it's definitely not.
No,
you know, there's other states where, you know, lessons we learn in Missouri could be applied to Alabama and Mississippi, and all of these other places. And if you bring these local stories to a national level, then we can talk about like big change.
Yeah.
But right now we're just talking, we're like holding on to threads of like one case and this case and that case. And how can we solve this particular situation? It's like, no, it's like it's a bigger topic than that. It's changing legislation.
Yeah. And so for people that are listening right now, you know what's going on in your community, like down your street and in your city. And so if you know that there's an issue happening and it needs some attention, send a message to us, find us on Facebook.
We'd love to talk about it.
Send an email, like, let's talk about these things that are not being covered, because there's way too many injustices going on in our own country that are falling by the wayside. And we are our best support system. Yep. We need to help each other out.
And I think also, lastly, before we head out, we're just, sending thoughts and good vibes to the Minnesota mosque. There was a homemade explosive device that caused an explosion Saturday morning. And not a lot of news people are talking about it. The president's not talking about it. And there's a reason. It's because they're Muslim. And it's very sad, that's happening. So we want to talk about these things. If you have things that you want to be talked about, like I said, we are absolutely down to do that. But up next, we have
very exciting.
We have an interview with Prashanth Venkat, who was the head writer of the 2017 White House Correspondents' Dinner. And he helped with Hasan Minhaj about the speech that he did, which was fantastic. And he is also a writer on Bill Nye Saves the World,
which got an Emmy nomination.
Yeah, which got an Emmy nomination. So stick around. We're going to do that. James, happy birthday.
Thank
we
you.
Love you.
We love
you.
Happy birthday.
Let's not do it. All none right. of us can sing.
But I love you.
But we'll sing later.
But thank you
Let's
so
address
much.
We'll sing the rumors. At the
party.
Love you.
All right. Love you guys too.
Join birthday right. party. Be there.
Stay tuned.
Bit. Bye.
Welcome back to Reba Bell, everyone. Thanks for tuning in. We're really excited to introduce our new next guest. His name is Prashanth Venkat.
Welcome. And hey, what's up, guys?
Welcome. And he's a comedian and writer in LA and I guess throughout the country, we could say.
Well, the head writer of the 2017 White House Correspondents' Dinner and a writer for Bill Nye
Saves the World,
which has been watched in this apartment studio.
Live
and
live
also
studio audience.
Recently live nominated.
They've witnessed it
for an Emmy.
Yes.
Oh yeah, Emmy nominated.
Oh gosh. Yeah. We're all these things are crazily things. True. Somehow.
Yeah.
We're just trying to list all our
gold medalist.
Michael Phelps inspiration.
Inspiration.
He actually coached Michael Phelps.
Won the Tour de France, but then gave it to the second place guy.
It's weird that this tangent has arisen already, because I was just talking to my girlfriend about how Michael Phelps has like more gold medals than India or something. Like just in like the recent past, like. I was just in the shower and it was mind boggling to me how few gold medals in any legitimate sports that India has. Mm-hmm. And Michael Phelps has so many.
He has
and
so many.
It's very frustrating for a country with like 1.3 billion people.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh. They can't find any gold medalists in anything other than rifling or archery.
Archery and fencing?
I feel like I don't know. Yeah, I'd have to look it up. I don't know. I don't know off the top of my head.
I'm basing that off of almost nothing, but I feel like I heard it once.
Cool.
Which is really good on a political fact based.
Let's do that. So let's jump in. How did you get started in writing?
So I basically started doing stand up in Chicago about 10, 11 years ago. And then I toured for a while, did clubs and colleges, a lot of colleges throughout the country. And then I moved to LA. And then I was still doing stand up. And this is, again, a very abridged version.
Mm-hmm.
Started I wanted to get into TV writing, but you can't really make money doing stand-up in LA. So I quit. Not quit,
wait,
but
you
I
can't
stopped.
Make money doing stand-up in
it's
LA?
Yeah.
Sorry, Nick.
Nick, I know. I know these are things
we'll
you're...
We'll give them.
I gotta go.
Everybody hurts sometimes.
So I picked up a day job and started to learn how to write for TV and stuff like that, and then somehow figured out a way in.
Yeah.
Miraculously.
What was your favorite college? I'm just curious. Do
you
ever
perform
in Michigan?
I did perform at Michigan.
Yeah, go.
And it was your favorite.
Good.
I can't remember. It was years. Let me tell. Actually, there is not a favorite college, but a favorite range of colleges. So a lot of times college towns are either totally nowhere or they're in big cities and they're completely saturated by the big city. But the perfect range is the college that's a big college town, but it's very far from other cities. So when you go to perform there, even if you're not a name, all the students will come out and see you because they're like, hey, a comedian came in and we all want to go check it out. So, you know, if there's 7,000 kids at the school, like 500 or 600 will turn up for just a comedy show, and they're awesome, awesome shows.
Yeah. That's cool.
Yeah.
That is cool.
So maybe there is hope in stand-up.
On the college circuit.
Yeah.
Look get at out.
That. No, but even that, like, it's kind of dwindling a lot from from what it used to be. Like, they used to do a lot more bookings, but I don't know. I think, like, a lot of celebrity, they're doing more celebrity bookings, and they're not reaching out to lesser-known acts.
Sure. I guess I'll just get famous.
Yep. Good. Yep.
Reluctantly.
You do that. So how did you get from college tour to the 2017 White House Correspondents' Dinner?
A winding path of luck and working with the right people, which I think pretty much explains everyone's career.
I like to think that, like, you were like, I was doing a college show and I heard one single clapping and Barack Obama was there.
Yeah, I also like that the not president picks the performer for the next year's correspondence dinner.
Yeah, he's a funny guy.
He's like, this is part
like,
of my
he
legacy.
He went from president to booker of the dinner now. Yeah, like, that's his new job.
He's got a good eye. Got a good eye for comedy.
Multi-talented.
So, again, abridged version, but Hassan and I have been writing together for many, many years. I actually knew him in college because when you're an Indian comedian, people just tell you about the other Indian comedians and put you in touch. So we've known each other for a while. And then when I moved out to LA, we stayed in touch and we started writing stuff, just not even political stuff, screenplays, scripts, all, you know, anything that we just felt would get samples out there. And collaborating is a really, especially as a stand-up, it's very motivating, as you're finding with the podcast, because you do something alone and you're trapped in your head and it sucks. And then there's at least something that you can lean on other people with. So we started collaborating early, not really getting much anywhere. And then, you know, I started getting better opportunities to submit for stuff. And then he was doing more hosting stuff. And then eventually he got The Daily Show, started working there. And then I started working at, you know, Bill Nye and stuff. So along that path, the thing that really set us up to do the Correspondents' Dinner was this lesser known dinner called the Congressional Dinner, which happened in 2016. And he had gotten it just on they had reached out. I mean, it's like the Correspondents' Dinner, but it's like the JV version. And nobody watches it. So when he got the gig, he reached out to me and, you know, was like, hey, we should do this gig. It'll kind of help us refine our writing process and nobody will see it. So it'll just kind of exist in this world that, you know, C-SPAN tapes it, but they don't always put it up. And if you go on YouTube, you can find certain clips of the RTCA dinner is what it's called, but it's still not as well known as the Correspondents' Dinner. So it was just an opportunity to be like, hey, we're getting a shot sort of at the JV league. Can we actually execute? But the week that he was set to perform, you know, I went down to DC, and that week is when the Orlando shooting happened. So we had to rewrite our ending like on the fly in the last maybe 36 hours or something. And it was very stressful. But that closing message ended up getting put up online and like reblogged and went super viral. And it brought a lot of attention to that dinner. And after that, we knew that he was going to be in the running for the correspondence dinner. But after Trump got elected, we thought there's no way he's going to get it just because of the optics of it. You know, they wouldn't want to ruffle feathers with the administration by hiring, you know, a correspondent on a very liberal program to roast the president who hates Muslims.
Right. Yeah.
There's always that.
So, yeah, when he actually got the call, it was pretty jarring. We didn't know if it was real or not at first, but yeah.
Yeah, what were the first like days of that like? Because I do remember reading and hearing comedians talking about, you know, because there were some comedians saying don't do the correspondence dinner, and then there were you know, like what right. do you do? What were the first days of that?
Yeah, so like the first couple hours of it were heavily focused on how is this potentially going to hurt us or screw us, because you don't know all the sort of political reasons going, because these, when they reach out to comedians to do the correspondence, they go through their agents and their agents forward it to their clients, and you don't know where it's getting stopped at. You don't know if the publicist axed it. You don't know if the agent axed it. You don't know if the person who they're asking was like, no way. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, because it is like a political thing, it's been such a politically charged environment. You don't even know if the spouse of said person was just like, yeah, we don't want to attract that kind of attention or whatever. There's so many reasons. So we spent a lot of time just analyzing the angles of how we get fucked by doing this, especially because, you know, we're still very much so up and coming in a lot of ways. And Hassan is the lowest profile person to do the dinner. So if it, after everything goes well, it's great. So it seems like a no brainer, but prior to doing it, you just don't know if it's going to hurt you in some unseen way with, it's just very, very hard. So we basically spent the first day just ruminating on it. And the day we found out, we got the opportunity to go to a Knicks game courtside.
Double whammy. That's awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
I like you guys are like, you're like, should we do this? I don't know. And then they're like playing basketball right by you.
No, that's literally what really? It was. Oh. It literally was that.
I want to see that scene in the movie.
No, there. Yes.
You
could
probably find an old tape and just see you guys panicking.
You can.
Really? Oh.
Yeah. You can.
I'm looking it up right now.
I think it was a Knicks game where they played, I want to say the Bulls.
Okay.
I think they played the Bulls in some week of April this year, and we were sitting right behind the Knicks bench, and you can see me sitting there, and there are times where Hassan is gone because he's gone out to take phone calls from random people, and then he'd come back and you'll see me like just eating a hot dog, and then we'll like talk about it. This exists. This is actually crazy. I can't believe I forgot about that. Yeah, so there's tape that exists of us like figuring out what we should do at a Knicks game.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
We have to find it. We should link the game.
We're going to find it. Yeah. Yeah.
If you want to see.
That's amazing that happened after. The same day. I would have like also bought a lottery ticket and like gambled some money.
Yeah,
just to like, right.
Audition for Hamilton. You know,
something. I know. Audition for Hamilton. It kind of blows my mind that like because we were talking about this before, and I totally forgot to mention that happened.
Yeah,
that's wild. Amazing.
So you guys like decide to do it, and then what's the next step?
So the next step is, you know, most people, like I said, he was at the time. Now, you know, he's obviously more well known to do the dinner. Most people that do it are hosts of big TV shows, so they already have the infrastructure of like a writing staff who knows their voice in place. So for us, it was reaching out to our friends and, you know, people who we thought were really good writers to start putting the Avengers together, basically start figuring out what, you know, who. And this was actually a great lesson for me as the head writer for it, because you you realize that, you know, putting a writing staff together is very much so like putting together a basketball team. I mean, you want only a handful of specialists because everybody has certain skills. Like there are people that know takes and arguments well. They know how to weave a narrative structure through something. There are sharpshooters who you send them a take and an angle and you go, hey, I need 15 monologue jokes on this that aren't what Seth Meyers or Oliver did this past week. And they can just bang those out in like 4 or 5 hours and get you jokes. And then we had an interesting process where, yeah, so we had a faction of writers in New York and we had some people working remotely in LA and then other people in different parts of the country. And then we had people just sending in jokes via email and Google Doc and all that stuff. And then Hassan and I would go through all the material and basically put it in like a rough doc. And then every night we would go out and test out the set at the Comedy Cellar. I actually think we only had four weeks to put together. And within the 3.5 weeks that we started running the dinner, I think Hassan did close to 60 or 70 sets.
Wow. Holy shit.
Yeah. And every night we were just out. Like our day was basically, it was like a startup. I'd sleep on an air mattress at his place, get up at like 7 o'clock. We'd start writing immediately, going through the jokes that that we got the night before. Mm-hmm. Cleaning up so basically I had to clean up the revision, push it out to this was just like a system that I had sort of come up with to consolidate it for all the writers and the different in the different areas of the country. I would clean up the doc, push it out, and then say, hey, an updated revision for what we tested out last night is there. Takes are highlighted in a particular color, and then we start filling out jokes here. And then I'd hit up specific people to be like, hey, can you please focus on this, and can you focus on that? And then we'd go through it every day. We'd write it out, the set, and then we'd print it out, 2 copies. And then Hassan and I would go from basic, we'd write from, you know, 9 to 7, mm-hmm. and then we'd take it to the clubs from about 7 to 12, and then we'd go to bed and do the whole thing over for 3 weeks.
Jeez.
Yeah, we actually had to be very careful about how many copies we printed out, because by the end of it, once the announcement came and, you know, it was picked up by a lot of publications, like TMZ started following us, which was crazy. So we had to be very careful about how many copies we had to keep track of at any given night, because we could not, like, that's something we just absolutely cannot leave lying around.
Yeah. Like pick up those scraps of paper exactly. at the end of the night, yeah, take everything with exactly. you.
Or even people, like just being careful with people walking by with phones and taking pictures and stuff. It was something that we were very concerned about.
Whoa.
And yeah. not just your process of organizing all that, but I imagine there's a sense of responsibility about the content of what you guys are talking about. Like, did you feel like there was like a sense of duty to have the right tone for like the speeches? You know, like what was that like?
That's a really good question. So my big thing when we were initially talking about the angle of the dinner was to not do stuff that the late nights were doing consistently, because everybody can get that from the late nights. That's they don't need to see that at the dinner. But to answer your question more specifically about just keeping the tone right, it's like, yeah, we have to be really careful, because Hassan doesn't have the gravity that comes with maybe a veteran like Jon Stewart or someone. You know, he's a young guy standing at a lectern essentially to a bunch of old school journalists who really know their shit. I mean, like, you look out into you see, like, everyone you see is potentially someone you can like recognize if you follow journalism, you know. And there's like anchor like Jake Tapper sitting right there, like Jeff Zucker. It's like they're right there. So you have to we felt we needed to strike a balance between not having Hassan overplay his hand. Like, he can't pontificate to these people about how they should do their jobs, because it's kind of like, hey, fuck you. Like, you're early 30s. Like, who are you to tell me how to be a journalist or mm-hmm. shit on my profession, right? Now, someone who is like a heavyweight, like a Colbert or Jon Stewart, right? He's so much more trusted because he spent that much more time analyzing news, and he just carries that with him. But it, keeping the tone of the speech something that was like deferent in a way, but also, deferent in a way, but also hit on the points that we wanted to. I mean, you don't obviously want to lose the, you know, it's kind of a roast. I mean, that's kind of what the dinner is. So you don't want to lose that aspect of it, but you also don't want to come off like a petulant child kind of talking above your weight class. And so that was something we were very, very concerned about, making sure Hassan wasn't making overarching statements that made him sound too preachy or, you know, naive in a way.
But I think it was probably good then as well to have Hassan up there, because they, you know, here's a Muslim man speaking in front of a majority white audience.
Yeah.
And I think that's a perspective that is not often taken into account when you're watching how the news is presented to us. You know, we've got a 24-hour news cycle, and how often are they talking from the perspective of a Muslim man or woman?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And that's part of the reason why we tried to ground a lot of our angles in Hassan's subjective experience. I mean, that's kind of why the ending was the way that it was, and it guided a lot of the angles that we pursued, because there was a lot of material that we discarded that wasn't working, even though on paper it seemed like it would work, but it just doesn't fit his voice, because Hassan's strengths are, you know, he is a comedian, but I think his primary strength is that of a storyteller. So we were trying to weave an argument through the entire dinner and not just have it be small sections where we make fun of this group and this group. That happened, but I like to think that we couched it in a greater argument for that entire section. Oh, I mean, yeah. That was the goal.
I mean, yeah, especially the ending where he calls all the press minorities.
Yeah,
that's great. I mean, that was I think that was amazing, because it definitely did feel like there was a story there that you don't necessarily get. I mean, there are other White House correspondents' dinners that are amazing, but you never get as much of the story as I think you did with Hassan's speech.
No, thank you.
Yeah, it was amazing. I truly enjoyed it.
It was a really wild. Sorry, what's?
Oh
that?
No. I was saying, you didn't feel though that you had any like capital from the correspondent I'm sorry, what was the other
congressional
dinner? Yeah, because I remember watching that when it went viral. And then when Hassan got announced, I was like, oh, he's going to like, because you went after those guys, you know, in that first one. And so do you guys ever feel like you had like a little bit of leeway? Because I don't know. I felt like he like really went after them in that first speech. And I remember feeling like, yes, like he's going to totally go after these guys.
Yeah. I mean, to answer your question a little bit, but Yasser, you have to remember that we went into the congressional dinner not knowing people were going to see it.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Very low stakes.
Yeah. We said, you know, in a way we said what we wanted to say, because that is what we felt was honest to how the country was feeling at the time. I mean, the gun debate's still a big issue, but around that time it was really at fever pitch because of a string of police shootings and then the Orlando shooting and all that. So afterwards, I don't know. It's a tough question, because even the people that saw the congressional dinner is a small fraction of the people that really pay attention to the correspondence dinner.
Right.
So there is some overlap in that Venn diagram, but I would say it's maybe a fifth of the people that tune in religiously to the correspondence dinner, which is weird for me because I am one of those people. Like, I watch the correspondence dinner with like popcorn every year.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and I didn't even know about the congressional dinner until I had worked on it.
Yeah.
I didn't know it even existed.
Yeah. That's wild.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. That it's like, well, I don't expect anybody, like a lot of people, to see this. And then it just exploded.
Yeah. And the thing is that we had jokes in there that we were really proud of that nobody saw, because the closing statement, again, ended up kind of capturing the, you know, the virality of it was mainly focused on the closing statement.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did you have contact with other correspondents, staff writers from previous years, or any other like administration's writers? Because I know that like the Obama administration had a lot of, you know, Jon Favreau, John Lovett, those guys kind of contributed quite a bit.
Yeah, they did. We didn't have that much contact with past administration writers. It was mainly writers from the comedy world who had contributed to the comedians' performances. Mm. So, you know, we were testing out a lot of the material at the Comedy Cellar, and there were just so many drop-ins already at the Cellar that, you know, they were just willing to lend a hand. I mean, there was a surreal night that will forever be frozen in my mind. I mean, we're sitting at this table, and this particular night, Chris Rock walked in and kind of knew what was going on. And he even pitched in like his thoughts on the dinner. And there was a moment where I was sitting there. I was like, I can't, it was just beyond me. I could not believe what was happening.
I would die. Like Chris Rock, whatever he says, I'm just, okay. Yep. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Especially because he has experience because of 2004 as head of state. A great movie
that prepped him.
What is the guy's name, like Gilliam something?
I forget.
You remember the
what is the premise of that movie came out?
He is he like runs a bus station, and then the two lead Democratic candidates, their planes crash into each other and they die, so there's nobody running for the Democratic nominee, and the guy who wants to be the Democratic nominee in 4 years is like, nah, I'm not going to do it. Let's nominate some loser that's not going to win. And then they find Chris Rock, who's like a community organizer, quote unquote. But he like literally, he's like a bus driver. And then he runs for president. But it speaks to the people. And then he named Bernie Mac a bail bondsman as his vice president.
The amount of premise gymnastics that movie had to go through to get you to buy into like a Joe Schmo running for a president is crazy.
Oh, Maze Gilliam, I think is his name in the movie. President Maze Gilliam.
Wow.
Watch the trailer on YouTube. It's so funny. People are like, 2004, and then 4 years later, a black president. Like, people are like, I guess this started the trend.
Thought it was, they thought it was prescient.
Yeah.
Mm.
Hilarious. So after you finished the dinner,
yes,
what was the first thing you did? Sleep for 14 days?
What did I do? I think I just spent time with my girlfriend.
That's fair.
Yeah.
Was she at the dinner?
She did come. Yeah. She was very, very supportive. She does, you know, distance does not work well for her. So she was very supportive with me being in New York for a period of time. And then she actually came out to New York for the last week to just sort of be around, and where she works has an office in New York. So she was able to work out of there.
Oh, nice.
And it was great. I mean, the day of, I was just like this. There's a funny thing that happens with Hassan and I, where anytime we have a gig, be it private or something like this, the day of, I am an immense ball of stress. I just cannot. I just have so many knots. Even though I'm not performing, I'm just so nervous about the content, the material, making sure it's there. And he is just he's like firecracker. Like he's just so full of energy and so ready to tackle it. And then the moment something is done, I'm like, that was fucking awesome.
Yeah.
You know, or I'm like so Jones. I'm like, I can't believe we did that. And then he turns into a ball of stress, kind of waiting for feedback. And, you know, he, because the mistake, you know, the writing staff and he and I are the only people that really know of what went wrong. And so that's obviously blasting at a very loud volume for us, even though it was received well. The difference with the dinner as opposed to the congressional dinner, though, is that since it's being televised live, you're getting like live tweet updates, and you're also the moment it finished, it was weird. I just got like a flood of texts from people kind of like filling me in on what the internet was saying and, you know, how it was received at home and stuff. So that made it easier to sleep that night because we kind of knew that people were happy with it or enjoying it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then afterwards, I mean, I slept for a bit and then, started working on Bill Nye again, which is cool.
Yeah. How's How's Bill?
How's Bill? Is he everything I want him to be?
Bill. Yes.
Bill. Science is fun.
Yes.
That's what the song says.
This is what I've been telling people, is that Bill Nye is exactly who you hope Bill Nye is, and he really does care about science, and he cares about people and all that stuff.
What were you saying before? We were talking earlier before we started recording. Is he a guy there for this? Is he a swing dancer?
Yes.
He's like an amazing swing
dancer. Well, he is.
Because I believe he was on Dancing with the Stars.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, excuse me. I apologize.
Bill Nye is a very spry man who loves swing dancing. And yeah, and anytime we're in the office, or even if he's just kind of in his office and he's playing music, it's like old school swing music. He really loves. He is a very, his interests are very genuine. He loves it. And he loves, okay, childhood dream fulfilled. I remember we were in the parking lot of our office, and without giving too much away, there's something that we're doing related to Frisbees. Mm-hmm. And so we had a Frisbee.
I can't wait.
We had a Frisbee in the office, and Bill, for a week or so, would just come into my office at lunch and be like, "Hey, Prashant, do you want to toss a disc around?" Because I played a lot of Frisbee in college, and I don't think there were just many Frisbee players in the office, so he would just keep bugging me to play, toss a Frisbee around. So like for a week, every day at lunch, I would just play Frisbee with Bill Nye. It was amazing.
That's incredible.
Yeah, it was really awesome. And he's really good.
At Frisbee and science.
Yeah, because he played competitively in college.
Nothing?
Wow. Yeah.
Man of many skills.
There is nothing that you're saying that I'm like shocked. It's just like, I feel very warm hearing it.
Yeah.
But it's like, yeah, of course he's a good swing dancer who's amazing at Frisbee and just a genuine person.
Oh, I love it. And now on that show, how big is the writer's team?
The writing staff for that is eight large. So there's... It's split between four science, four comedy, and every so often I dip a toe into working with the science team, which I love to do. Partially because I enjoy it, but also because I also do have a degree in molecular bio. So
you know what you're talking about.
I know that makes no sense.
What
I don't
casual drop.
Did I tell you that?
No.
Oh, I didn't tell you. Yeah. That's what my degree in college was.
Molecular biology.
Which was very, I know, it makes no sense.
And it's got to be interesting to work on this kind of show right now in the face of an administration that is staunchly denying a lot of science, a lot of facts, a lot of
data. I know. Today, as the day we're recording this podcast, didn't a new report come out about climate change within the EPA or something like that, that they're worried that the Trump administration might suppress? Oh, I was just reading this in the New York Times.
I did hear something. Probably. But
there's a Guardian article right now that says the U.S. federal department is censoring use of the term climate change.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Well, that's splendid. That's just
great.
Can't
wait to hear what they're going to call it. Yep.
So, you know, the interesting thing about season one of Bill Nye is that we filmed it a week before the election. So we shot the show before we knew what was going to happen. And then after he got elected, I had known that Bill Nye's a little bit of a bug light for the alt-right because they already hate him for, you know, they hate on him all the time for not being a scientist. He's an engineer and an actor in their eyes. So they just always like pick apart his climate. Whenever he goes on Tucker Carlson, they just like shit all over him, even though like that's why his fan base loves him, is because he does go on Fox News and CNN and like yell at climate denialism. But I knew after Trump got elected that, it was really cool. Excuse me, that we were working on a science show at a time when it felt like we really need a science show that makes it more accessible to a lot of people. But I also knew that putting the show out was going to attract a ton of hate, and that is exactly what has happened. So,
but you're doing it right if you got people.
That's true.
Haters gonna hate.
That's what we tell ourselves.
Here on We Rebel.
You're not anyone unless you've got trolls.
That's right.
Oh, there's a ton.
So aside from content, obviously, what is the primary differences or similarities between political and scientific, I guess, writing?
Yeah, that's also, that's a great question. And this is something I thought a lot about while I was working on the dinner, because so much of what we run into with the show is that people don't have the same political, scientific lexicon that they do have political lexicon. You know, most of the word, because everyone's just so tuned into politics right now, there's just, everyone kind of is familiar with the Senate, with things like the filibuster, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, it makes it easier to convey political ideas. But with science, because science understanding and education is so all over the map, it's really hard to figure out where to start a particular episode or idea, because you don't know how many people you're leaving behind by starting there. And so if you go, as you know, as this is just a fancy way to say, if you dumb it down, it pisses off the people who are really into science because they want to learn more about the fringe of a particular field. But if you go too fringe, then you block out an entire audience who wants to know more but doesn't have maybe the basics to go off of. So that was a very stark difference between writing something that is for political communication versus something that's for scientific communication, that I've still been thinking a lot about, and how to bridge that gap, especially for science. It's very difficult.
Yeah.
Yeah. It sounds like an interesting challenge.
It is, but it's also
like, that's like the way you would put it if you were like adding it to your resume or something.
Yeah. It's a very difficult challenge because you piss both sides off. It's very hard
no
to compromise.
What you do, someone's going to be like, ugh, I
already knew that. Yeah. Totally. And the other thing too about science is there's not a lot of consensus for certain fringe topics because just more, we just need more experimentation and understanding and whatnot. And political, like, I think the reason why is things like real time and is still on the air, and why CNN's ratings are still so high, is because in politics, there's so much debate that can happen, but for some reason, people don't demand the sort of rigor of study underlying those arguments. Whereas with science, because the environment is to peer review heavily and really not make too many wild claims that are not based in science, it doesn't really leave, you know, you can debate topics, you can debate hypotheticals, but to get into like debates about science, it's also trickier to do. So it's not as much of a prize fight to watch all the time.
Sure.
If that makes sense.
I like that there's been a lot of subtle references to the idea of like writing and boxing. Do you box?
No, I don't.
Because you were telling the heavyweights, and Hassan was a lightweight and the punches, and I was like, yeah.
Oh man. Yeah.
I don't know anything about boxing, but I was like,
I don't either. Okay, I don't watch boxing at all.
See the
but
arm movements
that
Nick is doing.
I did not
right
even
now.
Realize that I had all these subtle boxing references.
Yeah. Lightweights, heavyweights. Well, Hassan and you are both heavyweights in our books.
That's
oh,
right.
Gosh. Yes.
So that's right.
Yeah.
It's too kind of you guys.
But yeah, so we should say that if you want to watch Bill Nye Saves the World, it's on Netflix right now, the entire first season. They're half-hour-long episodes, I think. Something
yeah, about
along
20
that.
To 30.
Like, easy watch. Like, give it a
yeah.
Learn
give
something
it a whirl,
new, kids.
Also,
everybody.
Also an easy watch, the Congressional Correspondents' Dinner, the White House Correspondents' Dinner. They're really fun. They're what they're amazing and really well written, and,
oh,
and
gosh.
There's a story with the too comedy. Good. So, also check out Hassan's special.
Yeah,
it's really good. I highly recommend Homecoming King.
Yeah,
on Netflix.
King, excuse me. Yeah. Anything else? Do you want to plug your Twitter or Instagram? Or
I'm terrible at the social media. I really don't tweet that much, and I wish other people didn't either.
Us too.
Certain people, certain presidents,
certain people yeah. in the Oval.
But I don't know if you want to keep. I don't even announce the things I'm doing. But if you want to hang out, it's my handle is VENKATETC, Venkat, etc.
Cool.
Great.
So yeah. Awesome.
Well, you can follow us on Twitter at We Rebel Podcast. Is that right?
Yes.
Yep.
On Instagram at We Rebel Podcast. We're also at whatsacreative.com. Search out We Rebel, and we are on iTunes. leave us a rating, subscribe,
a little review. Tell your friends. Perhaps.
Tell your friends.
Yes.
All right.
Isn't the review the most, like, they you should definitely review.
You should definitely review 5 stars. But if you're a troll, go somewhere else.
Yeah. Or bring it on. Check out Prashant's work. Watch Head of State. Yes. Guys.
All right. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Thanks for coming in, Prashant.
Oh, it was such a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Right. We'll see you all next week.
Bye.
What's a Creative Podcast Network?